there's a almost a pun here. I've got to watch out. I want to talk about wise speech. And of course, that includes the written word as well as, and I guess the electronic word more than ever before. I don't know if we have to update the sutras to talk about such new developments. The inspiration for this reflection comes from my favorite radio program, The Minefield. I don't know if other people listen to that, but I just find that extraordinary. Their use of language and their semi-spontaneous, you know, thinking out loud is just really, really grabs my attention. But through the month of April, they had a series inspired by, but not textual, by Ramadan. And the one that really caught my attention was about chastening speech or purification of speech or restraining of the tongue. I don't know what the best translations are, so I don't know much about Islam at all. I've also been struck going to service organizations like medical places by the signs there about zero tolerance, you know, please don't abuse our staff, you know, that kind of thing. Or often when you connect on the phone, you get this sort of introduction. It's a really kind of, I don't know, it makes me very uneasy. And I'm sure it's a need that they have, or they wouldn't be talking about it or signing about it. Now, evidently in Islam, as I say, and I don't know much about it, there are 8 types of speech that the tongue should be guarded from uttering. In other words, things that you've got to be really careful about, some of which sound, you know, very familiar to people who have encountered the Buddhist cautions of right speech, one of the Eightfold Paths. Now, I'm not going to talk about those or make a comparison, though it may be quite interesting to do so at some time. But what really grabbed my attention as the presenters ranged from gossip and personal criticism to hate speech, and of course it's very well timed because of the political campaign as well, and how these, what their ruminations and reflections might say about the Buddhist concept of right speech. Among other things, they pointed out that there are, you know, basic characteristics in some ways. The speech can be outward going, can also be pointed quite inwardly. It has effects in both directions. Outwardly, which is I think what we think of mostly, abusive speech, generally seems to be a means to attain our own ends at the expense of someone else, elevating us as opposed to the target of the speech that we're employing. And I just happened to be, when I was thinking about it, there was just an article in The Age. It'd be one of so many kinds of things. This was just about an account about someone trolling someone who has some expertise in gender diversity. And she got the following comment from somebody who was trolling her. So you're doing tertiary education studying genders. Well, I'll make it easy for you to pass. There are 2. So, you know, I understand you. You just have no understanding of this. I'll set the record straight. So it's very much about me rather than about the other person. It provides an occasion maybe to elevate, well, you know, you your view of the world is wrong. But the most important thing is mine is right, and I will assert that or aggressively here. And it also illustrates one of the favorite tools, of course, of unwise speech, which is the use of sarcasm. And we're seeing that so much, you know, in so many ways. But, of course, the political campaigns are exacerbating that. So that's sort of the outward dimension. Perhaps a more insidious thing that isn't often thought about so much is what it does inwardly. And here I thought that the presenters, Waleed Ali and Scott Stevens, were very, very insightful, that it leads that hate speech or that kind of abusive speech also leads to a kind of poisoning or corruption of our own heart and mind. So it helps form our own sense of self, as we just said, and the way we view the world. It's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, it seems to me, because on the one hand, we think what we're doing is voicing or writing a pre-existing thought, something that's been with us. But in fact, thinking and language are not separable. It's not, our thinking is not independent from our choice of words. That in fact, language is in some ways constitutive of reality. They quote throughout, well, Scott Stevens in particular likes Iris Murdoch, I now find out, whom I'm not very much acquainted with, and he quotes her at several times, one of, in connection with this inwardness, he quotes her saying, or writing, "We can only see a world we can say." Or I still remember when I was studying, took a course in anthropology way back when I was an undergraduate, something called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. It seems to be still used, but the idea is that language shapes our culture. If it doesn't actually create our worldview, it certainly reinforces it. So we can't be, in a sense, we can't see, and Iris Murdoch puts that really well. You know, we can only see a world we can say. And another, just a little hypothetical that they use, which made me think, they use the situation of the abusive footy supporter, you know, criticizing in no uncertain terms a player on the field. And they raise the question of, what if the abuser understood the context of the player's life at that point? So let's say the player just has she might have a very sick child at home or something like that, not concentrating, drop the ball, you know, something like that. Would that make a difference if we understood that, or if we made an attempt to come from the place where the person we're criticizing is? And it also makes me think that often when we do feel critical, it's useful to ask questions rather than to make statements. Or an implied question, something like when I'm on the phone, I've had some dealings with Centrelink or banks, one of my least favorite organizations. And maybe start out, and so I can feel quite agitated about that. Well, it seems like things are quite busy today where you are. And you often get the person, of course, they're not happy about that either. And just to make an inquiry, and it doesn't diminish your question at any time. Now I need, in fact, if anything, it probably helps the two of you connect so that they might be more helpful to you. So given these problems, what do we do about it? Again, Iris Murdoch is quoted in the program. The use of language, it strikes me as a kind of Zen, almost like how Dogen or Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, inventing kinds of words. So Iris Murdoch talks about unselfing, in particular, unselfing the fat, relentless ego. How, this is what we've got to do. Now, the question is, of course, how do we go about it? And two suggestions came out of that program. Speak only necessary words. If it's not necessary, don't speak. It may be necessary, and it may be necessary to use very strong language in some cases. But what is necessary and what is not? And they had a guest on the program, and I don't know the source of this, who was very interested in aphorisms, and he suggested one. When it pleases you to be silent, speak. When it pleases you to speak, be silent, that ego part of it. Okay, so this you know, leads me, of course, to how does this relate to Zen? And it seems to me what it has provided is a kind of psychological or philosophical way of understanding the difficulty and the importance of right speech. Now, in some ways, as we know from the Heart Sutra, on the unconditional or absolute plane, what comes to us via our perceptions is empty. It has no intrinsic value. So what somebody else says abusively or something like that, or the comment on, in a sense, we're imbuing it. Our senses give us the judgment about it. It has no value in itself. So no eyes, no eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, or mind, none of these things that through which we're getting our view of the world. But we live mostly in the realm of the conditioned or relative reality, subjective kind of reality. Right speech is often characterized as abstaining from false speech, malicious speech, harsh speech, idle chatter, things like that. There are various translations, of course, of that. Something I found very useful along those lines, though, was Joan Halifax's recasting of these as six gatekeepers of speech. So she turns, instead of thou shalt not do this, this, and this prohibitions, she turns them into questions and suggests we ask ourselves, is it true? Is it kind? Is it beneficial? Is it necessary? And is it the right time? And she adds, then she goes to Thich Nhat Hanh and just reminds us that some speech is necessary at some point. But Thich Nhat Hanh has written, have the courage to speak out about situations of injustice, even when doing so may threaten your own safety. And of course, his life, particularly in Vietnam, illustrates that. And another dimension is suggested by Rick Hansen, who extends it to thinking, which he defines as self-talk. So our self-talk helps create our own ego-based self-image. So I might think, I'm a rational thinker whose viewpoints are evidence-based, you know, everything. And therefore, everything that I say is true. I'm that kind of person. Don't argue with me, because I'll cite the latest research on, you know, X, Y, and Z. And I just thought, well, last night I broke several glass bowls when I was putting things away after doing the dishes. And I'm often, the language I use to myself isn't very nice often. And I can be very critical, but I sort of wonder if I can't be generous to myself, you know, what effect that has on, you know, my looking at other people. And I was also just thinking, this is quite recent, the last year, using the word old for myself for the first time. And what, of course, that can be purely descriptive, it's a demographic, and I'm older than average, you know. But it also carries all these connotations, and I'm feeling that I'm not as effective. I'm breaking glass bowls, you know, or something like that. I'm forgetting the car keys, that, you know, all that kind of stuff. So where does that leave us in our effort to engage in unselfing and releasing ourselves from this fat, relentless ego that Iris Murdoch talks about? Even if we can't remember all of Joan Halifax's questions, perhaps a quick visit to our own practice principles, which we are quite familiar with if we've been part of this group for a while, to remind ourselves that we're often caught in a self-centered dream, and to leave behind our baggage of that self-centered dream and just be just this moment and none of the baggage that comes with presupposing what somebody else is saying and why they're saying it, or even ourselves. This moment, what's the next thing to do? What's the practice after our glass bowls break? Clean it up. It's not good or bad. Just do it. Anyway, those reflections that came about over the last couple of weeks. I think it's been 3 weeks since that program that I just happened to hear caught my attention.